from Pacifica Radio, this is Democracy Now!
They say it's American aggression. I don't know what form this will take, but from tomorrow we are likely to see, you know, more anger being shown in the streets of Khartoum against the United States.
The U.S. attacks Afghanistan and Sudan. Today on Democracy Now! We'll have a report from Khartoum. What exactly is the U.S. targeting? What about respect for international law? Robert Fisk, Phyllis Bennett, and others will be with us here to discuss it. And 2 years after President Clinton signed a bill to end welfare, many former recipients have forced themselves into workfare programs. Lots say they have lost their rights as a result, and all workers are at risk. All that and more on Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! Pakistan says it took a deadly hit from one of those U.S. missiles that was supposed to strike neighboring Afghanistan. It says at least 5 people were killed.
A Pakistani foreign ministry spokesperson says it seems there has been some, quote, technical error, as he put it. He would not say where exactly the missile struck. Pakistan has condemned the U.S. attacks on Afghanistan and Sudan. The head of the FBI said on Friday that Washington's decision to launch airstrikes against targets in Afghanistan and Sudan was not necessarily a direct result of the probe into attacks on U.S. embassies in East Africa. FBI Director Louis Freeh said, "This is an investigation proceeding on many fronts. I cannot detail or characterize the type of evidence we have gathered in Nairobi." Former apartheid president P.W. Botha was found guilty today of ignoring a summons from a panel investigating apartheid-era atrocities. Botha, age 82, could get up to 2 years in jail or an unspecified fine. Because of his age and frail health, a fine is considered more likely. Botha ignored a summons to appear before South Africa's Truth and Reconciliation Commission, which wanted him to be quizzed on his role as head of an inner cabinet that launched a violent crackdown on black liberation fighters in the 1980s. About 30 supporters of the governing African National Congress Party demonstrated outside the courthouse today, chanting, "Send him to jail, send him to jail." The demonstrators standing beyond the razor wire surrounding the courthouse carried placards and a banner. "We can forgive him for the past, send him to we can forgive him for the past, send him to jail for his arrogance," read one. Also in South Africa, South African President Nelson Mandela Friday called twin summits of regional leaders in Pretoria to discuss a peaceful resolution of the conflict in the Democratic Republic of the Congo. Mandela's initiative runs counter to the deployment by Zimbabwe and Angola of armed troops into the former Zaire. The presidential spokesman said Mandela had called Zimbabwe, Rwanda, Uganda, and the Congo to a crisis meeting in Pretoria on Saturday to discuss the rebellion against Congolese President Laurent Kabila. He said the meeting would be followed on Sunday by a full summit of leaders of the 14-member South African Development Community, or SADC. Mandela, chairman of the SADC, on Thursday repudiated Zimbabwe President Robert Mugabe's call for military intervention to bolster Kabila against a Tutsi-led rebellion and called instead for a summit of the regional grouping. Back in the U.S., seven black managers at Amtrak are suing the passenger railroad. They charge its senior management with fostering a hostile work condition and denying them promotions. They were joined by several former black managers at Amtrak, applicants who weren't hired, and a white woman who accused the company of punishing her for trying to combat racial discrimination. The lawsuit, filed in U.S. District Court in Washington yesterday, grew out of a similar one filed in April by track construction and maintenance workers in the Northeast. The latest lawsuit seeks changes in the company's employment and disciplinary policies and unspecified awards for back pay, mental anguish, attorney's fees, and punitive damages. Amtrak officials refused to comment on the specific allegations. They said they have programs in place to promote diversity, train supervisors, and investigate complaints. You're listening to Democracy Now! This is Laura Flanders sitting in for Amy Goodman. On today's program, we're going to be focusing for the first whole part of the show on the strikes ordered by Clinton against Afghanistan and Sudan. The ramifications of those strikes, which took place yesterday at about 2 p.m., continue to be felt. In Afghanistan, the U.S. missile strikes have been said to have killed at least at least 11 people, I'm hearing more like 22, and wounded 53 in attacks on two alleged guerrilla training camps in eastern Afghanistan. Of the killed, six were identified as Arabs, though their specific nationality was not immediately known, while five others were Pakistanis. And there are responses coming in from all over the world, an angry one from Sudan's president in response to the missile attack. Egypt's Middle East news agency quotes President Omar el-Bashir as saying Sudan reserves the right to respond to the American attack using all necessary measures. Other Sudanese government officials are calling the missile attack a criminal act, and they charge that President Clinton ordered it to get the attention away from his troubles in the Monica Lewinsky case. Sudanese civilians say they're outraged the U.S. targeted a factory in the heart of Khartoum. U.S. officials say the plant was making chemical weapons. Well, that's what we're going to look at next. Only 4 hours after the bombing yesterday, we spoke with journalist Amfred Taban, who is a reporter for Reuters in Khartoum, just outside of which the U.S. attack was made on a chemical establishment. We don't know what it was. Madeleine Albright said it had the precursors to the possibility of chemical warfare. Who knows what that is? We spoke to Amfred Taban about that question and just what was the scene on the ground. And Amfred Taban, you were in Khartoum today. Tell us what exactly you saw.
I saw devastation. The entire factory was almost completely demolished. It was, as you would call it, a direct hit. The laboratories, the stores of the factories were completely burnt out. It was only the administration building that partially remained.
Tell me what the target was that was hit.
This is a pharmaceutical company, a pharmaceutical factory that produces most of this country's drugs, like anti-malarial drugs and so forth.
A pharmaceutical company. We are being told that it provided, or it was the place where preliminary drugs were developed for use in chemical warfare.
Of course, that is extremely difficult to verify. But the Sudan government, of course, totally denies it. They say they do not produce any chemical weapons, and this factory was only producing drugs, life-saving drugs.
When you say it was a direct hit, as far as you know, were there any civilians hit and killed in this attack?
There are no reports of people being killed, but yes, people who workers in the factory were injured. There are about seven or eight who were working night shift who were injured. But when I mean direct hit, I mean the surrounding area was not hit at all. It was just the factory itself.
And how have people in the area responded? We are being told this is a heroic strike against terrorism. What is the response of people there?
The response here is the exact opposite. A lot of people congregated at the factory shouting anti-American slogans, shouting Allah Akbar or God is great. Whenever a leader or a minister comes, they would, shout and praise God and condemn the Americans. So the people here are very, very angry with this attack. They think it is an inhuman act and it is a criminal act.
What about the accusations the U.S. has been making that the Sudanese government has been permitting its country to become a harbor for terrorists? What is the truth of that allegation, as you know it?
As I know it, this Saudi businessman, Osama bin Laden, lived here for a number of years, I think almost 5 or 6 years. But then he left for Afghanistan sometime last year. He is, of course, being, pointed out as one of the terrorists. I do know he lived here for quite some time.
What about more broadly? He may have left. Did he leave an operation? Could that be what the U.S. is targeting? People, contacts, a network?
That is very, very possible. The owner of this factory is actually a Saudi of Sudanese origin, somebody called Salah Idris. I don't know whether he is being associated with Osama bin Laden.
To go back to the factory, Sudan is a country suffering from a famine. Widespread malnutrition presumably puts great demands on a pharmaceutical company to provide the kinds of drugs that you're talking about. What will be the effect on the health situation in Sudan of the destruction of this pharmaceutical company if it was indeed involved in the production of the antimalarial and other pharmaceuticals that you mentioned?
The effect definitely will be great because Sudan has very little foreign currency to import drugs. So this was one of the ways in which they thought they would beat, you know, this problem of hard currency, you know, to set up a factory here and produce the drugs locally, antibiotics and so on. So it would definitely have a serious effect because this factory is a very big factory. It's an $80 million investment. And it was producing most of this country's, antibiotics and other drugs. So the effects on the health of the people here would, I think, is going to be a bit great.
That was Amfred Taban, a journalist for Reuters and the BBC based in Khartoum, describing yesterday, just hours after the bombing on Sudan, the impact there and what he knew about the site that had been targeted by the Clinton-ordered assault. We're getting news as we speak that in Pakistan, one of the missiles America aimed at neighboring Afghanistan actually landed there, killing at least 5 people. The missile was part of the barrage fired yesterday at Afghanistan, where U.S. officials said they were targeting alleged military training camps. We've heard a lot in the last 12 hours about pinpoint accuracy, but as the Pakistani Foreign Ministry spokesperson Tariq Altaf said yesterday, it seems there has been some technical error. For more, we're going to go now to a reporter in Islamabad, Asafar Abbas, who works for the BBC, among other people. Asafar Abbas, welcome to Democracy Now! What exactly is the scene on the ground there, and what has happened with this wayward cruise missile?
Well, it seems that we have to take the word of the Pakistani Foreign Ministry. They are now saying that one of the missiles fired from the U.S. ship in the Arabian Sea into Afghanistan fell inside the Pakistani territory, hitting a village bordering Afghanistan. And the Foreign Ministry says at least 6 people were killed in this strike, for which an official protest has now been lodged with the United States.
What has been the reaction of the people in Pakistan insofar as they know what has happened and why it's occurred?
The reaction has been of sheer outrage. Since early Friday, people came out on the streets. There have been dozens and dozens of demonstrations in different cities. We are still getting reports of more protest demonstrations. There have been demonstrations in which the American flags have been burned. The effigies of President Clinton have been set on fire, and there have been very angry speeches. Most of these demonstrations have been by Islamic parties and right-wing groups, but many more people are joining in, and this is what has forced the Pakistani government to issue a very strong statement of condemnation of the U.S. action.
In that statement, maybe you could characterize for us how the U.S. strikes are being interpreted. Is there talk of this as having been an act of war? What is the language being used?
The language that is being used is it is a violation of international laws, a violation of the sovereignty of any country. And the Pakistan's real anger is that even when the U.S. decided to use its airspace for firing these missiles, it was not taken into confidence. It was kept in dark. And Pakistan now says, even if it is the United States, the only superpower in the country, it has no right to carry out such strikes against 2 sovereign states.
What do you think, just in closing, will be the next step in this ongoing tension between Pakistan and the U.S.? It was only a few months back that the U.S. was imposing sanctions on your country for the development of, or the testing, supposedly, of nuclear technology. What is the next stage here? How does this development change the already fraught relationship?
I think that is a separate case altogether. Pakistan and U.S. had been cooperating quite closely in combating terrorism, and it was Pakistan which arrested the first prime suspect in the bombing of two U.S. embassies in East Africa, and it was the basis on this arrest that further action was taken. Then two more people were arrested by the Pakistani authorities. So since Pakistan was cooperating in this way, Pakistan is being feeling being left out because the Americans didn't take it into confidence when they decided to carry out these attacks inside Afghanistan, leaving the Pakistani administration in a very vulnerable position because Pakistan has a very good relationship with Taliban. Pakistan wants to have a good relationship with the U.S., but now Pakistan is being pushed to a corner where, because of the local public pressure, it has to take a very strong position in condemning the U.S. action.
The Taliban, of course, being the ruling government in Afghanistan. Thank you very much indeed, Asafar Abbas, for that report, on-the-spot report from Islamabad. We appreciate you being with us on the line. My name is Laura Flanders. I'm sitting in here for Amy Goodman. By my side is Juan Gonzalez, New York Daily News columnist, co-anchor of Democracy Now! Juan, we have some experts waiting in Washington. All of this news is breaking as we speak.
Yes, and once again, we're confronted possibly with a former American ally in covert operations turning around if the allegations of the U.S. government are true. We have with us a Frank Smith, a freelance reporter. His latest article entitled One Man's Jihad, about Osama bin Laden, who, according to the U.S., is a chief suspect behind the bombings in Kenya and Tanzania, appears in this week's Village Voice newspaper here in New York City. So I want to welcome Frank Smith.
Smythe,
I'm sorry. And could you tell us a little bit of who is Osama bin Laden?
Thank you, Juan. Good morning. Osama bin Laden is a radical Islamist figure who got his start back in Saudi Arabia when he was 16 years old, getting involved with radical groups there. Then the event that radicalized him, however, was the Soviet Union's 1979 invasion of Afghanistan. Osama bin Laden flew to Afghanistan days after the invasion began, and one of the first people to begin trying to organize an anti-Soviet resistance there among guerrilla forces, forces that eventually became known as the Mujahideen. One of the great ironies, as you pointed out, Juan, is that the CIA wound up supporting the Mujahideen as well. And the CIA, which was once on the same side of the Afghan war with Osama bin Laden, of course, is now attempting to track him down. After the Soviet campaign, the anti-Soviet campaign in Afghanistan, Osama bin Laden returned to Saudi Arabia briefly as a hero for his efforts there. But he quickly had a falling out with the Saudi royal family. He became a rising figure within the Saudi opposition movement. And the straw that broke the camel's back was the decision of Saudi Arabia after Saddam Hussein's in 1990 invasion of Kuwait to allow U.S. troops to deploy in Saudi Arabia. This is something that outraged bin Laden. His position, as he stated in many interviews, is that the United States must withdraw from all Muslim lands, but especially the Arabian Peninsula, the lands of Mecca and Medina, the two most holiest sites for Muslims worldwide. And certainly there's a certain irony there that the bombings that took place this month in East Africa occurred on the 8th anniversary to the day of the first deployment of U.S. troops in Saudi Arabia in preparation for Desert Storm.
So, in other words, not only was he a former ally of the United States in covert operations, but his hatred of the United States is a direct result of the Persian Gulf War, of our war there, isn't it?
The U.S. presence in Saudi Arabia in association with the Persian Gulf War is his largest and main complaint against the United States, yes.
We're going to talk in a moment with Robert Fisk more about Osama bin Laden, who is supposedly the U.S. chief suspect behind the bombings in Kenya and Tanzania, and the pretext on which these attacks yesterday afternoon, were made. Before we go there, back into the topic of who exactly bin Laden is, we need to take a 60-second break, and then we'll be right back for more discussion of bin Laden and the questions with respect to international law that this situation involves. You're listening to Democracy Now! Mm-hmm. You're listening to Democracy Now!, the exception to the rulers. Sitting in for Amy Goodman, I'm Laura Flanders here with Juan Gonzalez. We just heard reports from the scene in Khartoum and also in Islamabad, Pakistan. And we're going to be discussing the U.S. attacks on Afghanistan and Sudan here on this portion of the program, and talking more in a moment with Frank Smythe and Robert Fisk about the ostensible target of those attacks, Osama bin Laden, who, according to the U.S., is the chief suspect behind the bombings in Kenya and Tanzania. Who is this man? What motivates him? Just what will be the likely next steps of him and others who are witnessing world events as they transpire today? But first, I'd like to ask Phyllis Bennis, who is a senior analyst at the Institute for Policy Studies in Washington and the author of Calling the Shots, How the U.S. Dominates Today's UN, to respond to the very forceful message from the Pakistani government and also from the Sudanese government. In the wake of these bombings, there are accusations that the U.S. really is the terrorist here, and talk of international law that has been broken by this U.S. attack. What exactly is the law, the legal picture here, and what do you understand to be the likely repercussions? First, the international legal picture. Phyllis Bennis.
Well, you know, Laura, the reality of international law is that it's set by the most powerful adherent to it. International law in today's world is very much a function of what the United States says it is. What we are seeing here is, in my view, a very cynical undermining of any hope of an international response to the very real problem of international terrorism. We heard yesterday from General Hugh Shelton, the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, that, quote, the international community should reject terrorism, should refuse to harbor terrorists, etc. But in carrying out this kind of a unilateral military strike, the U.S. clearly undermined not only the U.N. efforts that are underway to create an international campaign against serious terrorism, but other multilateral efforts as well. There are a number of people speculating already that the U.S. Focus, the Clinton administration focus on this question of self-defense, claiming that the only reason that the timing was now was because this was an issue of self-defense, was in fact a way to get around Article 51 of the United Nations Charter, which requires countries to consult with the Security Council and to consult with the United Nations before engaging in military activities under any circumstances, the sole exception being that of self-defense. Now, it was clear that at the time that Article 51 was drafted, what people had in mind was invasion, that if a country is invaded by another country, it is certainly allowed to defend itself without having to get prior permission from the United Nations. In this situation, that's a very hard argument to make. What we really have here is a military act by the United States that was designed primarily for retaliatory purposes, not primarily for self-defense. So the question of the violation of the UN Charter stands as a very strong reality. The international response, I think, reflects that. In the region, only Israel has supported the U.S. strike. In Europe, only Great Britain has supported the U.S. strike.
And Japan in Africa, I understand it's Uganda that is supporting the U.S., and we know that the Ugandans and the Rwandans are on the U.S. side, as it were, in the conflict in Congo. Juan exactly. Gonzalez here had a question.
Yes, Phyllis, in listening to Secretary of State Madeleine Albright and Secretary of Defense Cohen at their press briefing yesterday, I was struck by this self-defense argument of Albright's. It sounded very much like the old Israeli preemptive strike rationale, that we're going to hit them before they hit us, regardless of whether there's any real proof that they're basically asking the rest of the world on the faith of U.S. intelligence estimates, because the investigation with the FBI is still on the ground back there in Kenya and Tanzania.
Well, that's exactly right, Juan. This is a situation where the U.S. is asking the American people and the rest of the world to take on faith that there is this level of evidence, not only of bin Laden's and his associates' involvement in the embassy bombings in Africa, but as well in supposed future bombings that were so imminent that this kind of a bombing campaign that has killed, we now know, at least 6 civilians in Pakistan and perhaps many others, in other places, we haven't gotten all the casualty reports yet, that somehow that's all justified by this claim of self-defense. I think we have one more example here of how the U.S. is putting itself above international law. It's very similar to the position that the U.S. took in opposing the moves for a landmines convention, opposing the creation of an international criminal court, based on the view not that those things were wrong, but that they were only needed for everyone else in the world, and that somehow the United States, as the only superpower, had the wisdom, the goodness, and the appropriate ability to judge itself in a way that it did not have to hold itself accountable to international law. It flies in the face of what even General Shelton spoke of as the need for the international community to be involved in the fight against terrorism.
To bring back in Frank Smythe, the freelance reporter whose article on Osama bin Laden appears in the current issue of New York's Village Voice, Frank, you portray the Osama bin Laden operation in Afghanistan as running kind of parallel to the CIA's own. Can you tell us more about the relationship there, both opposing Soviet occupation of Afghanistan, both using underhanded means to support and fund guerrilla movement? What was the relationship, Frank Smythe?
Well, as far as we know, there was never any direct relationship between bin Laden and the CIA, but there was a parallel relationship, as you state. Bin Laden was involved in bankrolling many efforts of the Mujahideen. He built roads, tunnels for them. He also financed safe houses for them across the Khyber Pass in Afghanistan. In addition, bin Laden helped finance the bringing in of up to 20,000 Islamist idealists from around the world who came to Afghanistan to join the Mujahideen cause. And on top of that, bin Laden himself fought as a Mujahideen guerrilla, fighting in many battles, including the 1989 Siege of Jalalabad, which was a key contest which eventually compelled the Soviets to leave and withdraw from the country. So he certainly someone who did everything he could in terms of his own resources and risking his own life for the Mujahideen cause.
And in terms of the impact of this attack, what's your sense in terms of other Muslim governments like Pakistan? Even in Albania, there was a lot of cooperation with the U.S. investigation of these bombings in Africa. What is going to be the impact on those Muslim governments who were involved in cooperation now in terms of this recent attack?
I think that's a very good point. I think especially when you're talking about Pakistan, there could be a reaction from this bombing that could undermine U.S. efforts to bring bin Laden, to make him stand trial, if in fact there is enough evidence to bring an indictment against him for the East African bombings. I think there are a number of indicators, beginning with bin Laden's own statements back in February and then this made ABC News, to indicate that he may in fact have a connection to these attacks. Certainly bin Laden has threatened to attack U.S. targets. He's admitted attacking U.S. troops in Yemen in 1992. He's admitted sending Mujahideen veterans to attack U.S. troops in Somalia in 1993. And he's praised actions like the 1993 bombing of the World Trade Center. So certainly I think there is evidence to suggest that he could be a clear suspect in these bombings. But the problem is, by taking unilateral military action, the United States could be shooting itself in the foot, because one of the most important pieces of evidence that could have been produced and still may perhaps be produced in a potential case against bin Laden would be evidence collected by Pakistani law enforcement authorities after the bombing and their interrogations of suspects that had flown from Kenya to Pakistan shortly after the bombing. Certainly now, if depending on Pakistan's reaction to this to these latest retaliatory strikes, that whole effort could be thrown in doubt. And certainly I think it would be preferable for everyone that if a link is proved, a definitive link is proved between bin Laden and the East Africa attacks, the best thing would be to make him stand trial and attempt to bring him to justice.
One person who has followed one shot in the foot by the U.S. after another is Robert Fisk, who is a journalist with the Independent newspaper, British-based newspaper, based in Beirut. He has met with Osama bin Laden even recently and has reported consistently on how actions like this one by the U.S. fuel an anti-U.S. Fundamentalist fervor that comes back on occasions like this to, well, worse than haunt history and the current life. Robert Fisk is with us now by telephone from Lebanon. Robert, tell us a little bit more about Osama bin Laden and some of the reasons behind the hatred that he spouts, the rhetoric that he uses, and the threats he makes.
It's bin Laden, not Laden, not Laden. Osama bin Laden, well, he was born a Saudi. He was a great hero, and when we loved him in those days, of course, when he was fighting the Russian occupation of Afghanistan. Some of his men were actually trained by the CIA in the very same so-called terrorist camps which the Americans fired their missiles at last night. The Americans knew what they were shooting at. They set these camps up in the first place, although we're not hearing that from the Pentagon. Bin Laden fought with great courage in that war, and that's generally acknowledged and accepted. When the war was over and the Russians left, he was disgusted at the faction fighting inside Afghanistan and moved to Sudan, where he spent some time constructing new roads. Construction business of Bin Laden is one of the reasons why he's a millionaire. The Sudanese, under American pressure, obliged the United States by throwing him out in 1996 and sending him back to Afghanistan. And it was there that he conceived his growing fury at the continued American military presence in Saudi Arabia. Remember that the Americans, when they went to protect Saudi Arabia in 1990 after the Iraqi invasion of Kuwait, promised that once the war was over or once the Iraqis had withdrawn, U.S. troops would go home. But not all of them did. There are still thousands of U.S. military in Saudi Arabia, which is, of course, the country which contains Islam's two holiest shrines. And there's also many tens of thousands of U.S. civilians and personnel working there. Bin Laden, as well as angry at the corruption of the rulers of his country and the presence of the Americans, was also, during my last meeting with him last year in his mountain camp way up on this ice-covered mountain in southeast Afghanistan, he was also obsessed with what had happened at Qana in southern Lebanon a few weeks before. You may recall that at Qana, Israeli artillery shelled a UN base for 17 minutes uninterrupted, killing 106 of the 800 Lebanese civilians who were taking shelter there. I remember that bin Laden kept referring to this, kept going back to it, asking if I'd been to Qana at the time, which by chance I had. He kept calling it a crime of international terrorism, mimicking the same words, of course, which are now used about him. And I think that if you look behind all this rhetoric, there's a man who feels that he lives in a corrupted world, who wants an ideal world, that's the most frightening thing about him, who clearly wants to live in a country ruled by Sharia law, an equally frightening thing about him. I imagine he can be quite happy with the Taliban's ferocious rule in Afghanistan, and a man who feels that many of the problems of Muslims in the Middle East come from the West, and in particular from the United States.
Now, you say in your article that appears in today's independent newspaper that President Clinton saying that Mr. bin Laden declared war on the U.S. and now declaring war on him is exactly what Mr. Laden, guilty or otherwise, as you put it, will have wanted. Tell us more about how you think he will react to this. And then I think we need to go back to establish what trace of guilt there really is linking bin Laden to the African embassy attacks.
Well, I've heard more American diplomats in my life today using the phrase compelling evidence than I've ever heard before, and I haven't heard a shred of what this compelling evidence is supposed to be. You know, someone set those bombs off at the U.S. embassies in Kenya and Tanzania, and it was a wicked, evil deed which cost the lives of many hundreds of innocent people. My suspicion has always been in this case that if they didn't organize it, Arabs were probably involved in some form in the bombings, although we still have no clear judicial proof of that. But linking bin Laden to it seems to me to be a rather odd thing to do. Clearly, he looks a bad guy. We love hate figures. We used to have Ayatollah Khomeini, we had Abu Nidal, the Palestinian killer, we had Colonel Gaddafi, we had Colonel Nasser before that. We used to have Yasser Arafat when he was a super terrorist before he became a super statesman by making peace with Israel. Now we have a man who was a superhero and has become a super terrorist. I think that what you have to do is to say, well, hold on a minute, can this guy living up here in this remote area of a country that doesn't even have mains electricity, mains drainage, or telephones actually run a, quote, international terrorist network? That's a very exotic thing to think he can run. When I last saw him, sitting in this frozen tent with an air raid shelter 25 feet high, cut into the living rock behind him, made during the war against the Russians, by the way. He seemed to me to be a very, almost a lonely, a very isolated man who seized upon the Beirut daily newspapers, which he found in my bag, and started sitting in the corner of the room, poring over the pages, trying to find out what was going on in Iran and the Israeli-occupied West Bank and what was going on in Saudi Arabia. If this was a master of world terror, as we're being told by Washington, he clearly didn't know much about the world he was supposed to be terrorizing. He certainly would like to be seen as public enemy number one. That is what he has always sought. Even when, 18 months ago when I saw him, he was largely ignored by the Americans. Now, Mr. Clinton, the President of the United States, has actually said he is public enemy number one. He must be very pleased with himself, Bin Laden, this afternoon. He's been attacked. He can claim he has been the victim of an assault against international law. He can claim that his men have been martyred in the battle against Americans. He would not, I think, have much sympathy over the bombings in Africa. He would not show much compassion, which is another frightening side to him. One shouldn't be romantic about Bin Laden, even though we can't prove his innocence or his guilt. He's not a person one would like to have as one's own leader, believe me. Nonetheless, I've been listening in Beirut, where, of course, the message sometimes comes across in a slightly different form, to all these Pentagon people saying that there is compelling evidence, and now he's being linked to violence against Mubarak, attempts to kill Mubarak. He's being linked to the New York bombings. I was under the impression that the culprits had already been sentenced and sent to jail for that. And now, heaven spare us, he's supposed to be responsible for the attempted killing of the Pope. I mean, this thing is reaching gone-with-the-wind proportions. Do all Americans, I ask myself, and forgive me because I know I'm talking to an American audience, do they all believe in the Hollywood version of reality? I have to step back and say, hang on a minute, this is not what it's like on planet Earth. Guy undoubtedly does hate America, but I don't think he's capable of doing all that.
What would, in your view, be a more principled, not to say more effective, way of handling or dealing with Bin Laden or his kind?
There's only one way to do it. America would have to adopt a fair, straight down the line policy in the Middle East that favored neither side. They would have to stop giving their unconditional support for an Israel which is prepared to tear up the Oslo Agreement by building yet further Jewish settlements on occupied land which doesn't belong to Israel but belongs to the Arabs. They would have to end what is fast being seen by Arabs as the genocidal sanctions against the people of Iraq, sanctions which are clearly not hurting the horrible and wicked Saddam Hussein. They would probably have to withdraw their troops from Islam's holiest land. That would help to protect Americans. Firing cruise missiles, I fear, will not do so.
Robert Fisk is the Beirut-based reporter for the British-based independent newspaper. Thank you so much, Robert Fisk, for being with us here on Democracy Now! We're going to give our guests in Washington, Phyllis Bennis and Frank Smythe, an opportunity to wrap up after the break. But first, 60 seconds for stations to take an opportunity to identify themselves and people to think about what Mr. Fisk just said. I'm Laura Flanders, sitting in for Amy Goodman. You're listening to Pacifica's Democracy Now! Yeah.
You're back with Democracy Now. I'm Juan Gonzalez here with Laura Flanders, and we'd like to get some final comments from Phyllis Bennis, the senior analyst at the Institute for Policy Studies, on the comments that we just heard from Robert Fisk, and how you see what's going to happen now in the international arena in regards to this U.S. attack.
Well, you know, Juan, I think that Robert Fisk was right on the mark when he spoke of the need to actually look at U.S. policy in the Middle East as a root cause of terrorism. That's something that does not get addressed in this country. There's an assumption somehow that our policies have nothing to do with the rise of terrorism that's so often aimed at Americans, that questions of double standards are not a problem, that all the various issues that are the real grievances of people towards American troops, towards American policy in the Middle East, are not real. And I think that's what was very valuable in Robert Fisk's presentation. I think that we have to be very clear that these kind of military attacks, even aside from the morality, aside from what we may think about them, they don't work. In 1986, the U.S. tried to do the same thing in Libya, aiming at Colonel Gaddafi. It didn't get Gaddafi. It got his three-year-old daughter. In 1996, the U.S. tried to do the same thing in Iraq, aiming to kill Saddam Hussein. It didn't get Saddam Hussein, but it did get Leila Al-Attar, the well-known painter in Iraq. And now this year, the aim was taken at bin Laden. They didn't get bin Laden. Who did they get? At least six Pakistani civilians, perhaps more. We don't know who all they got. But the point is, these kinds of attacks don't work. What we have to do is look back to the international community, as General Shelton said we should, and take seriously the need for collaboration, consultation with our allies. And the definition of allies has to be broadened. When there's a terrorist attack, as there was in this horrifying attack in the embassies in Africa, why wasn't the United States jumping to call a meeting of the Organization of African Unity to discuss it? Why not talk with South Africa, the government that has close ties to the U.S. but also has the most prestige and the most influence in the region? Why are these other forces being ignored as they are? This is the real problem. General Shelton uses as a rhetorical point the need for international communities' involvement, and the international community must reject terrorism. But everything the U.S. does sends a message that says, we don't have to deal with the international community. We are the superpower. We can ignore international law because we are above it. That does not make me feel safer as an American who travels in the Middle East.
And Frank Smyth, we have just about a minute on this segment. Could you give us your final comments on the effect of these attacks on stopping international terrorism?
Well, I think it's a risky move for the United States, and it's too early to tell whether or not this is going to have any effect in terms of curbing bin Laden's activities and whether or not there may be a fallout effect which could undermine U.S. efforts to try and prosecute him. I think in terms of evidence, as Mr. Fisk raised, there is the suspect that was apprehended in Pakistan, which has, according to the Pakistani press and Monday's Washington Post, has implicated bin Laden. I think it'll be important to watch to see whether or not that allegation holds. And in terms of the World Trade Center bombing, I think it's worth keeping in mind that the engineer, if you will, of that attack, Ramzi Youssef, shortly after the attack, fled to Pakistan, where he stayed in a house in Peshawar that had been funded by bin Laden. So I think there is some connection, though it's yet been has not been proved in any criminal manner, between bin Laden and the World Trade Center bombing. I think, and also in terms of evidence, another issue which we haven't addressed, unfortunately, is the issue of Sudan's connections to bin Laden. While there is a long history between bin Laden and Sudan, I think there are very strong, there's disagreement within the U.S. intelligence community about whether or not that pharmaceutical plant that was bombed last night in North Khartoum is in fact a chemical weapons facility and was in fact trying to make chemical weapons. Secretary Cohen said that there was unanimity among U.S. experts about that. Yesterday, a State Department official said that he was aware of no such unanimity. So I think that's an issue we should be looking at in the coming days and weeks.
All right. Well, I'd like to thank Frank Smyth, a freelance reporter, and your article on Osama bin Laden appears in this week's Village Voice, and Phyllis Bennis, a senior analyst at the Institute for Policy Studies, and we'll be following this story in the days to come.
Thanks, Juan. Well, we live in a very strange country where the last 24 hours have been filled with applause from for the president, the very same critics who attacked him for making love seem to think it's just fine for him to be making war. And the contradiction or the irony just gets more intense, I think, as we look at this weekend, where it appears to be fine to spend money on missiles that we refused 2 years ago to spend on mothers, all of which is a sort of clumsy segue to our next segment.
Or that he may be a liar in his personal life, but he tells the truth when it comes to politics.
Right. Ay, ay, ay. Tomorrow, for those of you who don't know, marks the second anniversary of so-called welfare reform, the Personal Responsibility Act of 1996. To mark the anniversary, a group known as Work Fairness has sponsored a demonstration and rally in New York City, and other events are happening around the country. Welfare recipients in New York and elsewhere have been forced in large numbers into workfare programs, so-called. The recipients are expected to work in exchange for their benefits, but the workers are not unionized, and in many cases there have been serious reports of abuse and unfair working conditions. In addition, welfare recipients say they are working as hard as unionized employees but are not adequately compensated, and workers' rights advocates say that the whole setup undermines the power of organized labor in the U.S. From the ground up. With us in the studio are two organizers at the organization Work Fairness. One is Greg Butterfield. He's also a union organizer. And the other is Vandora Jordan, who is co-chair of the group Work Fairness. Starting with you, Greg, who does your organization represent in more detail? Give us a picture of some of your members.
Well, we have currently about 9,000 members in the city of New York who are enrolled in the Work Experience Program, as Work Fair is called here. And also Begin and other smaller workfare programs. These are people who have signed up that with us that they want to be active, that they want to join a union, that they want to fight for real jobs and equality, that they believe that they are doing equal work and deserve equal pay and representation. And we have been working together with a number of unions here in the city to try to further that struggle, and that's what tomorrow's demonstration here is about.
Vandora Jordan, tell us a little bit about the kind of workfare jobs that former welfare recipients in New York are now doing.
Well, they're not really former; they're still welfare recipients.
People who used to be getting AFDC now getting the current benefits.
Yeah. Well, speaking as a mom of two and on public assistance and a wet worker, I can tell you. The amount of hours that we put in, the workers put in, and we're not benefiting from it at all. I mean, we stand up there and we're cleaning streets, you know, we're picking up dead animals and God knows what toxins are in the bodies. And, you know, without the right proper protection, we're picking up drug, you know, needles and everything. And, you know, we're not getting the safety measures, how you can say, you know, without for us. And a lot of the workers so far has been complaining the health-wise, especially like in parks and sanitation. There's been complaints of, you know, asthma more now. I mean, being in an environment as such. Skin cancer, unbelievable. The outbreaks like crazy, you know, even though they wear the thin gloves, but that's not going to help them. Fortunately, I didn't have the opportunity to work in parks sanitation yet, you know. They put me in hospitals or, you know, a so-called internship, but I wasn't relying for a job. So, I mean, we put in so many hours. I used to do like 35 hours a week and only get 145-50 every 2 weeks. And doing labor such as, you know, computer work and all that stuff, like, you know, just regular clerical, you know, assistance and all that stuff. But, I mean, the point was, We weren't getting paid, and we weren't getting the benefits, or especially medical benefits. I think a lot of us wet workers, we feel we have the right to be in the union, you know, and number one, to stop the layoffs, for one thing, because the welfare roll is just going to get bigger. Giuliani says he has a plan. I tell you the plan is to build this workfare situation real big, and when you ask him the question, he can't fully answer it. You know, but what are you going to do about the workers that you laid off? I mean, unfortunately, they run out of everything. And then eventually they can't find work. They have to get on public assistance, but they have to, it's required that they look for work 30 days before they actually can get anything, any benefits. Unfortunately, it's real hard. And, You could just say if you were a big corporation and, you know, why would I want to spend all this money on regular paid workers when I could just call the mayor or the city of New York and get me about 100 web workers, you know, and I don't have to pay them anything. So, you know, that's the big question. And it's really, it's a bad situation, and everybody think it's okay, and it's not.
Greg Butterfield, I'd like to ask you, because this is happening all over the United States, and it's always been my view that welfare reform came about just at the time that the unemployment rate was reaching the level where employers would actually have a labor shortage and have to pay their unionized workers more money, so that it became, in essence, the whole welfare reform movement. Not only was it abuse of minimum of folks who should have been getting regular jobs, but it also depresses possible wage increases for the rest of the workforce. What you say unions have been cooperating with your efforts, but it's my sense that it's been largely a verbal support, that there hasn't been real resources put by the U.S. labor movement behind organizing welfare recipients. I mean, I don't know if you can talk to what degree you can talk about that, but it seems that if they were really concerned, they'd put much more of the resources of the labor movement into these projects.
Well, that's very true. I mean, there have been some outstanding union locals here in New York and in other cities, like Local 420 of AFSCME, which has been fighting the mayor over the issue of the public hospitals, that have really given us a lot of both material and political support. But to a large extent, some of the bigger unions that we originally had hoped, you know, would come through and really take this up in a big way have not so far. And we continue to sort of struggle with them over that, getting as much support as we can. And I think that now the issue is becoming much more critical for them, as the mayor talks about, you know, within 2 years expanding the WEP program to include like hundreds of thousands of people, and pushing it into nonprofit and private industries that are either have unionized workers or where unions are trying to organize right now, and it undermines those efforts. So, I mean, what you said about the whole attempt to drive down everyone's wages through workfare is very true. And now we're facing this potential of a global economic crisis that inevitably, whatever the Clinton administration says, whatever Alan Greenspan says, is going to be coming here to these shores, and the layoffs are going to start. And the unions have to take that very seriously, that threat of workfare.
And in terms of the overall welfare reform, where most people are supposed to be cut off completely after 5 years, mm-hmm. This is even a transitional program to that, isn't it? I mean, or in other words, will people who go into the workfare program remain for 10 years, or what's going to happen there?
No, I mean, what's happening here in New York for sure is that people are being promised jobs as they take a new WEP assignment, and each time that job doesn't come through, they're shifted to another WEP assignment, and it just keeps going and going and going until their benefits are exhausted. That's really what the mayor is playing at. You know, I just want to say that, you know, on the national scene, the real scandal that's going on here is not, you know, the Monica Lewinsky case. But what Clinton's real scandal is the welfare cuts, the 2 years of welfare reform, and these horrible bombing campaigns against our sisters and brothers in the Middle East and Africa. Why isn't there a special prosecutor appointed to investigate that? That's one of the things we're saying, because we don't want to just focus on Giuliani. He's like at the national center of it right now. But this is all coming from the federal level also. This is a nationwide policy. New York happens to be the epicenter of it right now. And that's why, you know, people are coming from Philadelphia, Baltimore, Boston, and all as far away as Milwaukee here to New York tomorrow to rally at City Hall at 1 o'clock. We're urging people to come. The demonstration, again, begins at 1 o'clock at City Hall. And for more information, you can call our office at 212-633-6646. I also want to quickly plug that.
Could you repeat that number again?
Yes, it's 212-633-6646.
Before you plug anything else, Greg, I'd like to just come back to Vandora for a second to ask about the demands that you're making, not just of the New York City Mayor Giuliani, but nationally. What are the national demands? What do people want now, 2 years after the passage of the law, which some people say, well, now it's the law of the land. What can we do? We just got to live with it. Vandora,
well,
Jordan.
Well, the first thing we're demanding, you know, if you're going to give us this welfare reform, so-called reform, and if you're going to sit up here and tell us that you're going to, it's guaranteed we're going to get jobs. After the 2 years, we want those single adults to have that job. We want them to have paychecks. We want them to have the right to be in a union. And as well for us ADC recipients, we want the same. You know, I mean, it's like we've been stereotyped and labeled so badly that everybody thinks that just because we're ADC or, you know, or just single people on public assistance, we're lazy and all this other crap. And it's a bunch of crap.
What about the possibilities of going to regular jobs from the work for assignments? You were referring to the kind of inability to get the real jobs, but what stands in the way of the of you being able to graduate from the internship or whatever it is into regular paid employment?
I guess it's the employers themselves, because everyone is buying into this these situations with web workers. I mean, come on, cheap labor. You know, who? I mean, what big business wouldn't love that?
Has that been your experience that you've done one work for assignment after another?
Yeah, my experience is this. When I've done my assignments, after they're finished, about 6 months, I can fill out applications in this place. I can still look for my regular job, which I do. You know, I carry a resume with me every day. But the thing is, before we can ever get a chance to be hired, they go over our heads. We're there. But they're over our heads and end up hiring someone else. So we're not going to get hired, so they replace us. Now we have to go back to the center and get another assignment. But it's set that way to keep you within the system, even though you're trying to get out.
That's a wrap. Thanks very much. We're very, very glad that you were able to come in today, Vandora Jordan. With you also, Greg Butterfield, both of you organizers at Work Fairness. It's just one organization of web workers and people on welfare and their supporters that is holding a major rally at New York City Hall, attracting people from all over the East Coast and beyond. Tomorrow, August 22nd at 1 p.m. for more information, you can call the number that was just given out, 212-633-6646. Tomorrow, for people who may have missed it, marks the second anniversary of the so-called Welfare Reform Act. You've been listening to Democracy Now! Democracy Now!, as always, is available by calling 1-800-735-0230. If that's if you want a copy of today's show or any other program of Democracy Now!, you can call 1-800-735-0230. You can also hear us on the web at www.pacifica.org, www.pacifica.org for Democracy Now!'s international web broadcast. The program is produced by Hisu Koo and Zachary Fink. Errol Maitland is our technical director, Michelle Garcia, our web spinner. Julie Drizin is our executive producer. From the studios of WBAI in New York, I'm Laura Flanders, sitting in for Amy Goodman with my co-host Juan Gonzalez. For another edition of Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now!